Today is April 9th, 1976. Today's interview is with Mrs. Leon Peterson in her home at 2012 North Church Street in Beloit, Wisconsin. My name is Clem Imhoff. Mrs. Peterson, I want to begin by asking you about, you were born and raised in Kentucky, which makes, now that's somewhat unusual for most black people in Beloit, came from Mississippi or Tennessee, yes. But your background is in Kentucky, and I was wondering what do you recall about your early life in Kentucky?
My early life was very happy. I was from a family of six children, only girl to live, so that made me the only daughter in the family of three boys. And naturally, I was my father's idol, being a girl. And my father always had a very good job. And I know it's saying a big mouthful to say he never let me want for anything that I asked him for. I always got it. Sometimes he would tell my mother that he didn't have anything, and I could ask him for the same amount of money and get it. So they always said I was rather spoiled. Perhaps I was. And my mother used to go to conventions, like church conventions. She was quite a church woman. And she was always going to conventions, different things of that nature. And I would always get to go because I was the only girl. She didn't want to leave me home. So they just thought she had one child, and that was me. But she was a mother of 12. She was married the second time, and she had six children by each husband. And I happened to be the only girl to live in the last set of children. And I had all of my sisters were older. The youngest one of the first set was old enough to be my mother. And, well, I just had a good time being the only girl at home. And then I finished school in Kentucky. They didn't have a high school. So I went to St. Louis and stayed with one of my sisters and went to school there, Sumney High. And then returning home, I got married. And to this union was two children, Horace and Arthur. And they're real. Their name is Horace Douglas Foree, and Arthur Melton Foree. Marrying Mr. Peterson in 1921, they took the name of Peterson at entering school here, and so they've been known by Arthur and Horace Peterson ever since.
Now, where was it exactly in Kentucky that you were born and raised?
Wickliffe, Kentucky.
And where is that located?
That's just the first town below the Mason-Dixon line. The first little town. 5 miles from Carroll, Illinois. We used to go across the river to Carroll to shop. And we'd go by boat. They had a big boat, was named Three States, because we went to Kentucky, Illinois, and Missouri. And we could go cross on the boat for 25 cents. And we used to go to Carroll and shop, especially for, well, just anything that we wanted, but particular shoes. And Carroll is, I don't know how large it is now, but it was a nice place. Wickliffe was right on the main line of the Ohio River, Ohio and Mississippi, and you could see the difference in the two waters. One was dark and one was muddy, You could see the line in on the boat. You could be up on the deck and look out and see the difference in the two rivers, the Mississippi and the Ohio River. And used to have excursions on the river. And I had a sister that lived in Carroll, and her husband played in the orchestra on the river, on the boat that would make this excursion trip. And whenever they were playing, my mother would let me go because I'd have a chaperone, of course, on the boat. It would be for, say 4 or 5 hours. It was a lot of fun. And we used to have on the river what they call a floating theater. Were you ever on one?
No.
No?
Tell me about it, though.
Oh, well, that floating theater, it was live, you know. And it put on performance of dancing and singing, just like you see on TV now. But this would be a floating theater. And it would come to town. And, I could go if I had some adult going. And usually it was one of my older brothers that would take me to this floating theater. Well, that was really grand because a lot of people, I guess, have never seen one, never been on a boat. The boat was very pretty. And, what do they call it? What do they call? I can't think of the name that they call that boat. But it was a floating theater. That's what it really was. And it would come, you'd have about two during the summer that would stop. I guess it went all up and down the river. I don't know. To Paducah and stop in Wickliffe and Fulton, Kentucky. They would make those stop. Clear on down, I guess, to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun.
So the river was a big part of your growing up there.
Mm-hmm.
Then,
mm-hmm.
Now, how long had your family, how far back can you trace your family's history? Had they been in Wickliffe for a long time? Did they come up from further south, you know?
No.
What was the situation?
My father was born in I can't name the town yet. And then my...
That down. Mm-hmm. Now, we were talking about where your father was born.
He was born around Bowling Green, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And he came to Wickliffe with his mother. And his mother was a slave. And she was one of these that, what they call, lived in the house with her slave owner. She was very good looking. And she was... partying, you know. I don't know if she was a full-blooded Indian, but you could tell she had a lot of Indian blood. And my father did too. You could tell he looked just like an Indian. But that was something that my father was rather ashamed of, being with mixed blood.
Now, why was that? Why did he?
Well, in those days. It's because his father was white and his mother was part Indian. And my mother used to tell us to never ask our father about his grandfather. We knew our grandmother, but never knew our grandfather. In the South, they tell me now, this is not that I know anything about myself other than what my grandmother and her sister would say. Now, her sister was a slave. She used to tell us slave stories. about how she ran away 3 or 4 times from her owners and how they treated her when they would find her. And she had a beautiful head of hair, and they'd always cut it off. Just real like a boys, you know. But
my this was a punishment for running away, was it?
Yes. Yeah, now, my grandmother never experienced that because she lived right in the house with the other people. And she had my father and another daughter by one of the owner's sons. And my mother would always say, don't ask your father nothing about his father because he doesn't want to talk about it. And he never did. I used to feel like it was a disgrace to be mixed blood.
So it was the white part rather than the Indian relationship. Uh-huh. Was there any problem with the Indian relationship, or was that
no?
That was okay.
No, we used to have gypsies. You know, they were Indians, and they would come. They was always very fond of my dad. I guess it was because they recognized the Indian blood. And my dad used to be afraid that they would steal me when I was a little girl, because I looked more like an Indian then, because I had long hair. My mother, I wore it in braids. I did, when I first come to Florida, used to think I had people would stop me and ask me if I was part Indian. I used to get mad at them.
Why was that?
Well, I didn't. Wasn't any here, and I wondered why they'd connect me up with Indians, you know.
See, I don't know if we have your father's family name down. What was your father's name?
Well, he went by Nunn. Mm-hmm. That wasn't his real name, though, but that was his stepfather's name, and that's the only name we ever knew anything about. N-U-N-N, Nunn.
And his first name?
Patrick.
We
all called him Pat.
Yeah. And do you know your mother's family name?
Her family name was Brown. Alice Brown.
Now, I wonder about, Cairo, Illinois has a reputation for being actually a pretty rough town, especially as in relation to relationships between white and black mm-hmm. people. And I was wondering if that was true then, and if you have any recollections about that.
Well, yes, it was. But I didn't have any personal, anything personal myself. But I've always heard that it was. We used to go to Carroll and go to church over there and to different things in Carroll. But never had any trouble. Yeah, Carroll's known for being raw. I went down one time, we drove down to bury my father, and there was a dentist that was living here, and he drove us down. Yeah, my husband was with
me. Who was this dentist? Who was the dentist?
Dr. Parks, J.I. Parks. Mm-hmm. He lived with us. So he drove us down to Kentucky. He liked to go. He liked to travel, and he didn't mind driving. So he said, we went over to Carroll. He drove over there. Now you don't go on a boat, you know. They don't have no boats anymore. They have built a bridge that you can just walk across or drive across, see? To Carroll. So he drove over, and he and my brother went over to Carroll. Well, they'd go over there to get beer or anything like that to drink, bring back. And I remember Dr. Parks laughing about, he went to a place and they called it the Bucket of Blood. That's so rough. It is quite rough. It used to be. I don't know how it is now. but I haven't been down in a long, long time. I don't have any relatives there. I was thinking the other day I'd like to go back to Kentucky. And I said to myself, what for? There's no soul there I know. Everybody's passed. They're moved away. But somehow or another, I'd just like to go back and see the town. Yeah. My mother and father owned their home, but it burned. We went down and buried my brother. They buried there on a Sunday. And that Sunday, we had his funeral. And my son and I got ready to come home, and we drove. And I guess we hadn't gotten any further than Paducah before they said someone had set the house in between my house and a friend of mine. Everybody was at church. Set this house afar, they think it set afar to get the insurance because wasn't anybody living in it, although it had furniture in it. And so my mother's home and a friend of mine it lived on the other side. And two other houses. There were four houses in that block. Every one of them burned to the ground. And when I got home that day, we got home about 12 o'clock. The telephone was ringing, and I unlocked the door and went and answered. And it was the minister that had taken care of my brother's funeral, a pastor of the church there, was calling me to tell me that these four houses had burned to the ground while... And they were in such a big way of burning, there was nothing they could save. They didn't save a thing out of them.
You mentioned before that there were stories in your family, I think it was from your grandmother, I'm not sure, about slavery.
It was my grandmother's sister, my father's auntie. Mm-hmm. She used to tell us stories about slavery.
I was wondering if you recall any of the stories that she told you.
No, not exactly. Only thing that she told us a story about her running away twice. And one time they found her. The second time they didn't. And she said that she had been hiding for a whole year before they found her. And she would go to different places, and that's where she would get something to eat. And some of them would let her stay overnight, you know, and some was afraid to. But she would stay whenever she could with somebody, you know. And then they would give her food, and then she'd hide around so she hid for a whole year. And when they did find her, her hair had grown out real long, and they didn't want to be, they just cut it off for punishment. Just like a boy, she said, just real close to her head. She was a real nice looking, tall Indian. She looked like an Indian too. And so did my grandmother. My grandmother looked very much like an Indian. And they had cut the hair off real close. But not my grandmother, but my auntie. Mm-hmm. And she got married, and she had a big family. Now, my grandmother didn't have such a big family that I can remember. See, my father had two brothers and two sisters. I think there was just five in that family. But they all weren't full sisters and brothers. There were just two. My father had one whole sister, and the others were half.
Now, what about your father's work in Wycliffe? How did he make a living there?
He was a railroad man.
And for what railroad, and just what exactly did he do, as you recall?
Yeah. Well, he had at first, I don't know what he did, but in later years, they had quite a storm, the most that I can remember. And the rain caused the hills to slide, and it covered the tracks. And then after they cleared all of that away, they built, I'd call it a little hut. He had a stove in there, at a place to keep warm. And he was to watch this place. He was a, I guess you'd call it a watchman. And he would go every day, and they had to keep somebody there every day to take care of this particular space in there. That was a very dangerous spot, especially if they had a ring. And that was for him to, if it looked like it was going to slide, he would stop the trains, you know, coming either way, north or south. There was the Mobile and Ohio Railroad and the IC. They went through. It was a regular railroad center. Used to have high floods in Kentucky. More so in Carroll. And they would, a lot of people would come over from Carroll for refuge in Kentucky. Kentucky's kind of hilly, you know. I know they had a big flood in 1913. And, oh, the town was just crowded with people. And they'd have, on the levee there, they would have to take sacks of sand and, you know, stack it all along the bank, trying to keep the water from, but sometimes it would go over anyway. And in this particular time, the dam broke, and it just flooded Carroll. Houses were just floating just like it. Well, you could just look out and see the a house, well, a house this size would just take it right off its foundation and be going down the river. That's a terrible sight to see.
Yeah, that's for sure. What about the education that was available to you in Wickliffe? You indicated there was no high school, but
eighth grade was high as you could go.
And what do you recall about the what do you recall about the schools?
Well, it was, they would have a small schoolhouse, wouldn't be any, well, be a little, schoolhouse would be about as big as these two rooms. And it would have about 25 or 30 children with one teacher, or maybe more. Trying to teach from the first grade on up. Yeah. She had quite a job. Okay. Well, we had men teachers too.
Was this a segregated school system there?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Were the did you feel that the educational opportunities available to you were comparable to those that white children had, or were there differences?
Well, I'm sure there was a difference, but at that time I never thought anything about it. You know, I didn't know that much about, you know, going to school until I went to St. Louis, and, you know, and you furthered your education until you really paid attention to what you had been receiving. I think the schools are still segregated there. I'm not sure. Because I haven't been there for a number of years. I don't know.
Now, could you tell us exactly about going to St. Louis? How did you arrive at that decision? And
that's my sister, you know, lived there.
I see.
And she had been to school and had a very good education. And me being the only girl, she just prevailed on my mother to let me go and further my education. And she told Mama that she would send me father in school if I still wanted to go.
Now, I'd like to ask, too, about your husband's background, if I may, and if you could tell us where he was born and something about his family's background, anything that he might have told you along those lines.
You mean Mr. Peterson?
Right.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Peterson was born in Pontiac, Illinois. He was born in 1892. His father was a Methodist minister, and he was also a barber by trade. And he would have a church, then he'd have his barber shop, see. And he made a very good living for his family, see, preaching and on the sideline this barbershop. And his mother was born in Pennsylvania. Now, just how they met up, I don't know that.
That'd be an interesting story. But
she was a musician. And actually, that was a lot of help to Reverend Peterson, his wife being a musician, you see. She could play for the choir and so forth and help him quite a bit. And they lived very good, but at that time, they didn't leave ministers in one location for over a year, 2 years at the most. They would always pick them up and send them some other place. I heard Mr. Peterson say he went to 4 different high schools. When he got to Beloit, he finished here. That was, you know, taking kids out of this school and sending them, you know, have to start a new school every year. It was kind of hard. And he finished high school here, so in 1910, he finished school here.
Now, his father was sent here then as a minister?
As a Methodist minister in 1909. And, of course, the mother didn't come right away. It was later in the year she came. But he brought 2 boys with him, and she kept 2 boys. They had 4 boys, and Leon was the older of the 4. They had a bigger family than that. Let's see. Had 7. Had 7 children. They had 3 that was older than these. But then they had 4 boys, one right after the other, about 2 years difference. And he came here to see about the church and so forth. Well, there's two of the boys come with him. And then the mother didn't come right away. She came in later years, and they lived over in South Beloit. Over on the other end of Park Avenue, right up from where we bought our little place. Then he went into service, 1917.
Oh, this was Leah.
My husband.
Your husband, mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
And he was over in France, I think, a couple of years. Then he came back. He was working for the Wisconsin Power Light when he went in service. He was working there, and he was taking care of a church building. Oh, Episcopal, I believe, over there by the Northwestern Tracks. I think it is. He was taking care of that when we got married. Mm-hmm. And working for the Wisconsin Power and Light. The Wisconsin Power and Light building was there where Leach Furniture Store at.
Now, how long did your husband's father stay with that was the Bethel Church here, right? Mm-hmm. Did he stay here for a long time then, or did he move on?
Really don't know. I don't know just how long he was here.
And what exactly was the situation at Bethel Church at that time? What did he have to do with the development of that church?
Well, I imagine it wasn't very big because there wasn't too many Negroes here, you know. 1909, exactly. It was a very few. And they had a church building. I'm not sure whether they had church downstairs or whether they had it upstairs. But when I came to Florida, they were having it upstairs, up over the living quarters. And I think perhaps that's what they did in 1909, I'm not sure. It is a very old building. Did you see the picture of it?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's a very old building. And
now, for the record, just where was that building located?
On St. Paul. It was down in there where, you know where the Wisconsin Power light space is down there now where they repair, right back of that. In fact, as a matter of Wisconsin Power and Light bought the land where this church building was. Uh-huh. And that's how they happened to buy where they are now out on Athletic. They sold this to the Wisconsin Power and Light. And of course, Mr. Peterson at that time was trustee of the church, and he got all that he could get for it. But he wasn't in favor of this church building, I mean the land. He didn't think that was an appropriate place for a church. It was more residential, you know, he thought. And he didn't really want the building there, but, you know, the majority wins. And the majority of the trustees thought it was all right. So they bought there and built there. And, of course, after they agreed to get it, well, he went ahead with it and helped to get the church built. And one of the men that worked at Wisconsin Power and Light, I don't know whether he was retired at that time or not, named Flory. He designed that church. He drew up the for the building.
Now, what about your husband's work with Wisconsin Power and Light? Just exactly what
Well, when he first started there, that's before he went into service, he was doing janitor work. And then he studied to do something different because he always had high ambition. And when he retired, he was a meter reader and repairman. He worked there 45 years. Should have been something else, shouldn't he?
Yeah, right. Now, were you acquainted with him before he went to into the service?
No.
Okay. All right. Did he ever tell you anything about that experience
in service?
In service.
Yes.
How did that affect him? What did he have to say about that?
Well, his work in the service wasn't. What I would say, it wasn't any dangerous job. He was, he done secretary work to, now I don't know just what officer this was, but he used to have to write out the passes and different things like that. He was a sergeant for a while. And then he got to be secretary to some officer. Uh-huh.
Now, here again, the Army at that time, I think, was segregated. And did he have a segregated experience in the Army, do you know? Did he ever talk about that at all?
No, he never. I don't remember any details of segregation. He was in France, and he learned to speak French. I think he got along fine in service.
Did he ever want to go back to France?
Yeah, we were supposed to go back on a honeymoon, but we never did get to take it. Yes, he always wanted to go back. And he brought home some pictures. He had a very nice girl. Seemed like she thought a lot of him. I read some of her letters. She was writing, a French girl. and her family was very fond of him. And I think he could have married this girl, but he had his mother back here, and I don't know, probably perhaps thought he wouldn't, she wouldn't be satisfied here, or he wouldn't be satisfied staying in France. I don't know which decision it was, but he brought our picture home. I have it now. And he used to tell me that the girl would say that a girl was really in love with a fellow when she gave him her baby picture. I've got her baby picture, and I got a picture of her in a little swing. Then as a kid, then I have one. It's a young lady. She's very pretty.
Did Mr. Peterson ever express any attitudes about France? Were things different there that he would have liked to have seen different here? Did he ever say anything about
that? Yes,
I think
it was quite different in France. I don't think that in some parts of it that they made any difference with some of the soldiers.
You mean between white and black soldiers?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Because he seems that he had a very good time there and enjoyed mm-hmm. his stay. Mm-hmm.
What I'm wondering specifically, I know he got involved in the NAACP shortly after he came back from the war, that would have been then, in the 20s,
but,
right? I was wondering if that had anything to do with
his involvement. I don't think being in France had so much to do with it. I think it was the immigration that had a lot to do with it. You see, when Mr. Pearson came here, there was a very few Negroes here. And they got along just fine until there was quite a group that came up from the South. And, I don't know, I guess they just had never been used to mixing. I guess it just wasn't what the whites here had expected. Yeah. Although when I first came here, they got along very nicely.
So it seems that while there were very few black people here, black people had mm-hmm. little trouble, really few problems.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
And it was only after the migration from Mississippi mm-hmm. that things started to happen.
Uh-huh.
Now,
of course, Mr. Pearson had never attended a segregated school. He didn't know anything about segregated schools.
Right, because his father was in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
In Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. An hour out through there. Mm-hmm. So he had never been to a segregated. He didn't know what it was to go to a segregated school.
I see. Now, I'm wondering about your initial impressions of Beloit. What did you think about Beloit when you first came here? And what brought you here for the first time? How did it happen?
I came here on a visit. I was just visiting my sister that had been living here for some time. Oh, my impression of Beloit at the time I came was very good. Because Mr. Pearson, he worked for Wisconsin Power and Light. And it just happened to be, I guess, that he was the only Negro there at that time, and for a long time. They've just, in the last few years, hired Negroes in the Wisconsin Palmer line. But Mr. Peterson was equal to any he worked with and superior to when it comes to education. They used to get him to type the letters for the union and everything like that. Yeah, because he had a better education than they did. But they didn't advance him on his education. He should have been, but he wasn't. He used to go every morning and take a reading what they call a, they had a machine, they call it the calorimeter. And that would give you the temperature for the day and the, anyway, could tell whether it was would rain, was likely to rain, all that. What do you call that? But he used to do that on his job, plus his other work. So he should have been advanced because he was a very brilliant man.
Now, I don't think we've talked about his education.
Mr. Really. Peterson only finished high school, but he took courses in subject. He took a course in law, and then he studied, he had some other courses that he took. He left one time the Wisconsin Power Light. They'd still didn't take it off of his record of time. He went into Chicago. He took the examination to work at the post office. And that's where he run into some segregation. He wasn't hired. He went to Rockford, took the examination, and he passed, with an average of 90-something. Then he went into Chicago and went in the post office because he wanted to go to school some more. And I was working for the manager of the Wisconsin Power and Light. He was a bachelor, and he'd always lived in hotels. So he wanted to move in this little Pebble Dash house up there that the DAR uses now. And he moved in there, and he wanted somebody to take care of the place. And he asked Leon, would he see if he couldn't find somebody that would take care of the place for him. So Leon come home. We were just rooming. I didn't have the children with me then. He says, so you know anybody wants a job? I said, oh, yes, I do. Oh, he says, no, I'm not kidding. He says, Mr. Lyons is going to move in at Pebble Dash house up there. He's going to have it remodeled. And he wants somebody to take care of it. Oh, I said, that's the job I want. Oh, he says, you can't work for him. He says he's traveled all over and says he's lived in the finest hotels. He says, and he's cranky about his cooking and everything else, his clothes and everything. He said, I wouldn't want you to try it, he said. I said, yes, but I want to try it. So he says, I'll just tell him I don't know anybody. I said, well, you tell him I want. Well, and when he went back, and Mr. Lyons asked him if he found it, he said, no. He says, I asked my wife if she knew anybody. But she said she wanted it. Oh, he says, would she take it? He says, she said she would, but I'd rather she wouldn't. He says, why? He says, well, I don't think that she'd be able to please you, Mr. Lyons. Says, you just travel so, and she couldn't, I don't think, cook. If you ever wanted to cook, I don't think she could do it. He said, you tell her to come by, see me. So he told me what he said. And I dressed up one afternoon, and I walked down to the office. And I went in, I told the girl I'd like to see Mr. Lyons. I had an appointment with him, such and such hour. So the girl called, said, yes, send her up. So I went up to his office, and he looked. He looked at me and said, so you are Leon's wife? I said, yes, I am. And you think you want a job? I said, yes, I'd like a job. I said, I'm just rooming now. I'm tired of just taking care of one little room. He says, you think you could take care of our house? I said, yes, I can take care of our house. He said, can you cook? I said, no. I don't think I could cook for you. I said, Leon told me he didn't think I could. He said, you cook for Leon, don't you? I said, yes, I do. Well, he says, there won't be much cooking. But he He says, I think you could take care of my house for me. I said, I'm sure I could. He says, well, I'll tell you, I'm going to try. I'm going to let you have the job. And says, there's nothing up there right now but my clothes. Says, I got all my clothes up there in the closet. You know, gosh, he must have had, if he had one suit, I know he had 25 shirts and everything, you know. And he says, I'm furnishing the place. As they finish it up, I'm going to have it furnished, so forth. And it was a beautiful little, just a doll house. He had it all, had interior decorated, come from Chicago, and fixed that place just like he wanted it. And he hired me. And I was $15 a week. Oh boy, that was money to me. So I took the job. So he said to me one day, he says, Osha, do you think you could launder a shirt like this? I said, why, yes, just a white shirt. All you got to do is wash it and iron it. He said, you think you could? I said, oh, yes, Mr. Lyons, I could do that. Wasn't anything else to do. So he thought, around all the week, you know, that he'd let me do his laundry. So he did. He never sent another shirt to the laundry. That was it. And he changed every day. Not one piece, everything he wore. Every day. He was the neatest, nicest, cleanest person I ever worked around. He used to smoke, and he quit smoking. But as soon as somebody would come in after he started staying there, and they smoked and use the ashtray, he would pick it up, and he'd be coming to the kitchen, bringing me this ashtray so I could wipe it out and bring it back. It was the nicest job, and he was the nicest person I ever worked with.
Now, how long did you keep that job?
He stayed in that house 7 years, and I stayed there until they moved away. They moved to, he got married after that, after I started working for him. He married his secretary, and they had two children, a girl and a boy. The girl's living. And they moved to Rockford, and he built a beautiful home in Rockford. Somehow or another, they got him out of the Wisconsin Power and Light. They went to Europe on a honeymoon after he got married. And my husband and I stayed up there in the house because they left right after they were married and went on this honeymoon. And he asked us if we would stay up there. So he had all these lovely wedding gifts and everything was, and he didn't want to leave the house with nobody in it. He said, you and Leon just come up here and live and just have your company come and enjoy yourself while we're gone. They were gone for a couple of months. So we stayed there in the house until they came back. And then I worked there 7 years before they moved away. And then he wanted us to go to Rockford with him. Living. They even built quarters for us. They thought, sure, we'd move down, but we didn't. My husband didn't like that kind of work. He says, anytime you were right on the place, you too, you know, at their disposal anytime. So he wouldn't take the job. He offered us good money, too. I've often wished that we had it gone, but my husband didn't want it, so we didn't go.
This is backtracking a little bit, but how did you and Mr. Peterson meet and get together? You know, you were in Kentucky and he was in Beloit, and just how did that happen?
I came here and met him, see? And then I was here from September until December. And then I went home for Christmas.
And that was in what year?
1920. And we got married in 21, March 26, 1921. We just corresponded. Then I went back home. My mother was here. She went home for Thanksgiving, but just before Thanksgiving. And she took the two children with her. And she left me. And she, it's a funny thing, she just thought Leon was the nicest young man she'd ever met. And she said to him, she said, Mr. Peterson, I'm going to leave O.C. here with my her sister. But I want you to look after her, he said. You're such a nice young fellow. And says, when she gets ready to come home, I want you to see that she comes right home and not stop in Chicago and stay. I had some friends living in Chicago, and I did stop over there. And he came in to see me while I was in Chicago. And he says, you know, I promised your mother that I'd see that you come home. He said, now, I hope you're not planning on staying in Chicago. But I had two girlfriends that lived in Chicago, and they were cousins to my first husband. And they really wanted me to stay. And he knew they were there. So he come in to see me. And he says, I'd love to see you go home, even if you come back. He says, because I promised your mother that I would see to you. And he says, now you promised me that you will. So I did. I went home. And one of the girls went with me. When I decided to go home, well, she went home. She didn't live in Wickliffe, but she lived out in a little town called La Cinta. And she went home to her mother, too. And this other girl was married. And she stayed in Chicago. And this one went home, but she came back to Chicago. I did come back, but when I came back, Leon met me in Chicago, and we got married. We couldn't get married in Chicago because he was from Wisconsin. And at the time, you still had to have a notice for 5 days, you know, to appear in the paper and so forth. And he, well, I guess going to Chicago, he probably didn't think about he'd have to do that. But if you went to Rockford, you'd have to do it, you know. So when we got in Chicago, when he got to Chicago, he met me that day at the train. And we went to get license. Now, he could have just as easy said he was from Chicago. And get. Well, he had three brothers living there and a sister. He could give any of them's address. But he was just that honest, he wouldn't do it. And we couldn't get a license. So they told us we could get license in Crown Point, Indiana, and get married there. So we took a train, went over to Crown Point, and got married in Crown Point, and come on back. That was the 26th of March. We had planned to marry Easter Sunday. It was the 27th, but we married 26th. And the first week out, we stayed in Chicago a week. The second week was in April. I came out here in the biggest snow I had ever seen in my life. Oh, snow was drifted as high as that lamp there. It snowed. It started snowing that Saturday night. It snowed all night, all day Sunday. And Leon went to work over to the church over here by the Northwestern Track. He was still taking care of that church. He was gone all day. And there was two young men. One was a woman's son. And the other one was her nephew. And they were living at the same place on Broad Street with a lady by the name of Mary Huggard. Leon was rooming there. So when we got married, she just fixed up this big room for the two of us, you see. And those two boys, oh, they kid me all day long about he's covered up in the snow somewhere. We didn't have a telephone. He couldn't phone back. They had phone at church, but Mrs. Huggard didn't have a phone. All day long, he was gone. And, you know, taking care of the church and shoveling snow. It snowed all that day.
Did you regret that you'd come up from Kentucky about that time?
Well, I don't know how I did really feel about it, but those boys, they just kidded me all day about Leon not coming home. Well, I just bet you he's covered up over there somewhere in the snow. He probably won't be back at all, they say. Just kidding, you know. And it was evening, though, when he came home, and he hadn't had anything to eat. And I didn't eat either, because I was waiting for him to come. I'll never forget that Sunday.
I believe that your husband was, I think, secretary of the first NAACP in Belize. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And now, when was that, and how did he get involved in that?
That was in 1919.
So that was actually before you'd come up here.
Uh-huh. I didn't come until 1920.
Yeah, he was quite a young man at that. Yeah. And did he ever tell you why he decided to
Well, it was just getting started, and he had all been reared in the church, you know, with his father being a minister and so forth. And these people that started it was church people. Mr. Stevenson, he was the cause of them bringing all this group from down Mississippi. And they built, Fairbanks and Morris built what they call Edgewater Flats. And Mr. Stevenson was in charge of that. And they had a large building where they had church and Sunday school for all of the neighbors out in there, the people that lived out in there. And it was quite nice. And Fairbanks had put the buildings up for them, the apartments and everything. And Mr. Stevenson was interested in this NAACP. So was a man here that had been here all of his life that I know of, was named Lawrence Owsley, and his mother was... The Missionary Society's name from her, she was quite a church woman. And see, Leon had always worked with the church. When his mother didn't play, he did. He played the piano. And he used to play for the choir, and he'd rehearse the choir and so forth. When his mother didn't feel like going, well, Leon would do it. So I guess it was just because he was connected with the church and things like that did. And there was a man here by the name of W.S. Williams. He was a barber, and he was the first justice of the peace here. So those people were all, you know, friends of his mother and father and Leon. So I think that's why he was interested in. He was interested for anything that, for the advancement of his people.
What did he see as the problems that would make an NAACP chapter here necessary? What were the problems he was trying to deal with? He thought that might help.
Well, I don't really know at that time. I imagine, though, they probably had some trouble with the blacks and whites as the group come in here. I don't know. Some of them, I imagine, it's already been, you know, come with that group, perhaps had some trouble. I don't know. I do know at one time there was a woman, I think she lived in South Beloit. She had... said that some colored fellow tried to rape her. Now, I don't know whether he did now, but anyway, they were looking for him. I heard that. So that could have been some of it.
What about public accommodations? Were they open to black people at the time? Restaurants, say, and... public recreation facilities, were they?
No. I don't know how it had been, but 19 and 20 it was.
Now, that you indicate, might they have been earlier? Did your husband ever speak about that since he'd been here as early as 1909?
Well, I think before that, they didn't pay any attention. There were so few that they could go anywhere and eat. It was after the group, a big group of them come in here, I think, that they begin to segregate them in eating places.
Now, was it specifically against these kinds of discrimination and segregation that your husband helped to organize the NAACP? Is that what he was trying? Was he trying to deal with local problems like that, really? Do you know?
Well, I imagine to some extent, yes.
And what really attracted him to the NAACP? I mean, why did he? Why was he particularly interested in this group rather than maybe forming a group, an independent group in Beloit? Or why did he specifically affiliate?
Well,
with
now
the
I'll tell you, the NAACP was started here in Beloit by a white professor. His name was, the first meeting they had was in Professor Crawford's house. He lived on Milwaukee Road. I think that's how it really, you see, the NAACP was organized by whites. Mm-hmm. The original NAACP was. And the first meeting that they had was in Professor Crawford's home out on Milwaukee Road. Mm-hmm. And they had, in fact of the matter, years ago, they had just about as many whites as it was Negroes in it. So I don't think it was all the Negroes' idea at all, from what I can understand, it wasn't. Because we used to have meetings, they used to meet once a month, and they would meet in different churches. And we used to have just a nice group of whites.
Do you recall who, were you a regular, were you an active participant in the NAACP chapter too?
Well, yes, I had my membership in, but I didn't do a whole lot of work. Leon, I used to help him with entertainments of some kind. We would have speakers here. We had, from the NAACP, we had Du Bois. He was a noted Negro. And we had his secretary now, he was on TV not too long ago. He's quite old.
Roy Wilkins?
Mm-hmm. And when they'd come to town, why, we'd have a reception or something, you know, for them. And I used to help prepare that and stuff.
All right. Well, we're almost out of tape here right now. Thank you very much, Mrs. Peterson.
You're welcome.